Good morning. This is Carol Ventura, Executive Director of Rhode Island Housing. This is the July 11, 2023 special meeting of the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners Credit Committee. This meeting is also being conducted telephonically for participation by the public. CJ Rotella, the Director of Information Technology, Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this telephonic meeting.
Good morning. This is CJ Rotella. This meeting will be recorded and available for your review on Rhode Island Housing's website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for specific Rhode Island Housing staff, all callers will be muted during the meeting. To prevent any background or noise, we ask participants to please mute your telephone if you are not speaking. If during the meeting anyone is having technical difficulties with the audio or accessing the call, they should call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
This is Corinne Myers, General Counsel of RA Housing. Members of the public can visit the RA Housing website to view today's agenda and information on each of the actions being taken. If the teleconference portion is interrupted, we will stop the meeting until audio can be restored. Chairman of the Credit Committee, Kevin Orth, will preside at this morning's meeting. Commissioners and staff, please state your name prior to speaking. And with that, I'll turn it over to Committee Chairman Orth to call the meeting to order.
Great. Thanks, Corinne. This is Kevin Orth. It is now 9:34, and I call this Credit Committee meeting to order. Carol, would you please take attendance?
Certainly. Commissioner Barry.
Here.
Commissioner Orth.
Here.
Commissioner Designee Cabral.
Here.
Commissioner Pryor.
Here.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's turn to agenda item 1, which is approval of minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on June 7th, 2023.
So moved.
Thank you.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any comments or questions about the minutes? Corinne, would you please take a vote?
Absolutely. This is Corinne speaking. All those in favor of the approval of minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on June 7th, 2023, please say aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay. The motion is approved by unanimous vote.
Great. Now we get to the meat of our recommendation for approval of proposed 2024 qualified allocation plan, the QAP. And I think if you could please present this, and I think what I would like to do is maybe if you could give an overview, talk about maybe some of the input that we've got from the meetings, public meetings that you had, and then I think maybe leave it at that, and then we could go kind of change by change, and the
sure.
commissioners could, you know, provide comments or questions one by one, just to make sure we get all the way through it.
Absolutely. Sure. This is Ann Berman. So here we are to talk about the qualified allocation plan, which we do annually. You know, as you know, the QAP basically establishes the priorities and the criteria that we use to allocate credits and monitor credits. And specifically, we score our 9% credits. You know, I think in a general sense, we use the QAP to incentivize our policy goals. So we did hold 2 stakeholder meetings. And I think we had really good turnout. We did them both virtually. You know, primarily, I think folks are pretty happy with the way the QAP are now. There's no surprise, right? They're still challenged by fluctuating interest rates, continued increases in construction costs, continue to be, a challenge for developers. We also had a couple of meetings with the Department of Housing, and they requested some specific changes, which I can kind of itemize. They wanted to emphasize the need for permanent supportive housing, and this included an increase in points awarded for the development of permanent supportive housing for 30% households. And then you'll see throughout the document sort of an emphasis on the importance of project-based operating support for 30% units, since we all recognize it makes it really challenging to have a development with 30% units if you don't have the operating subsidy. They asked that we delete the development total development cost as a threshold criterion. And finally, We've added some language that more clearly differentiates sort of the tax-exempt bond process from the 9% process. So you'll see some expanded language there. And then we've sort of itemized all these. So I can go through them one at a time or, you know, hit the highlights.
Yeah, we'll stop there. I'll take a motion. And then we can get into the
okay.
Motion to approve.
I'll make a motion.
Motion. Okay.
I'll second.
Thank you. All right, great. Now we can get maybe into questions or comments. Stefan, would you do you want to leave this off? Because I think the bulk of these are coming from your own.
I'm very happy to
go. Okay,
thank you.
Okay.
I'd be happy to chime in if it's useful, but no, that'd be great if you all did.
Okay, okay, certainly. All right. And why don't we just start off with the first change, and if there's any comments or questions, please, Commissioner, speak up.
Right. So if it's okay with you, I'll skip the ministerial stuff, which is really all about the dates, and then jump to the added reference to the tax-exempt bond financing. And I think the language that we worked out, I think, is good. You know, and I think the timing is makes sense. Historically, we have not used 4% credits for new construction. And so we now, as you saw at the May board meeting, right, we're getting on with the additional resources that we have, we are able to use bond financing for new construction. So the language just basically it does a better job of clarifying for developers who may be less familiar with QAP and with the LIHTC process, kind of how we review and take applications for both 9% and then for the tax-exempt bonds, which generate the 4% credit. So,
I'm sorry, any questions about that? I think that's a good move. I think it's very helpful to those developers that just want to do a 4% deal.
Right,
and,
right.
And maybe in years to come, we could even expand on that a little bit, that section.
Sure, sure. The next one is just a clarification of, around the Department of Housing. There's some additional language here, basically identifies the number of Rhode Islanders experiencing homelessness. Some additional language, sort of again emphasizing the need for both the availability of units for housing choice voucher holders, as well as, again, just I think it's an emphasis on sort of the need for 30% units, which I think is we all recognize is, you know, an ongoing challenge in the state. I think the next one that is sort of more substantive, it's the one on page 17, section
Okay. This one on page 16. So
I apologize.
So sponsors should ensure that their marketing reaches households with tent-based vouchers. I think the concept is very good. I think as a developer, and I'm probably question, what do I have to do to meet that?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we could clarify. You have to include the units on the statewide website. You have to, you know, notify the local PHA or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, can add context to this to provide guidance. We can add it.
Yep.
And we do have our asset management group has sort of the statewide housing locator. So, and I know they encourage most of our developers to post their units there, which I think is probably one of the most effective ways to make them accessible.
I think you can make a couple of suggestions right in here or suggest that on our website they're available. What do you think would work best?
I think we do a little bit of both.
Great.
Okay to move on, Kevin?
Yeah, oh, yes. Definitely.
Okay.
It is. I'll just mention that it is a major initiative for us moving forward with Chris's area and our asset management group to align developers in their units with folks that are on the Housing Choice Voucher Program waitlist and encouraging people to select from the coordinated entry system for 30% units. So we're working very hard, particularly for those who receive the HBF dollars, the operating dollars, which is very helpful.
Section IH, we added language regarding permanent supportive housing for households experiencing homelessness. And again, this is sort of a just a overall the three or four changes in Section 1 related to the number of individuals or families experiencing homelessness and then the importance of providing housing. So again, I think two, three language changes that I sort of capture the spirit of what we're trying to do here.
Conceptually, we're really driving, I think, a greater emphasis to the extremely low-income persons and recognizing that these developments only succeed if there's an operating subsidy.
Right.
You don't mention how much an operating subsidy is available, how many units this could, you know, support. Do we at least know that? I don't know if we necessarily need to publish it, but are we going to be able to do, I don't know, 15 units per each of these three developments for a total of 45 units?
I think it's an open question simply because there are multiple pots from which to draw that operating subsidy. Certainly, as Carol mentioned, we have the HPF BLI. We're very hopeful that shortly in the fall we will have ERA $2 that will be available for operating support. And then some of the, I know Providence, for example, just put 50 project-based vouchers on the street, an RFP for that. If there's project-based assistance, again, it's not something that we can say is absolutely going to be there necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's, I would hesitate to put a unit count just because of the fluid nature of that subsidy and how it rolls out.
Chris, did you want to speak to that?
Just the ERA II money that we're working really hard with the state to make that available, and I think the number that we had estimated, if the dollars become available, would be over 200 units. Mm-hmm.
Over 200.
So for subsidized for 20 years.
How long a period would that?
20 years to be in compliance with the ARPA.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So that would be my big hope.
Yeah. And also, as you know, with the 20-year commitment, something you can underwrite to, because it will cover the compliance period.
Right.
I think that's a segue to my next question. In other states, I've seen, project-based voucher or something like that, but it's only good for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Does that count towards this, or do we have, it needs to be 5, 10, 15? I think we should probably put some requirement in there. We're requiring that there's operating subsidy, so I think we should...
Yeah, and again, I think, for us, when we're looking at a deal, unless it is something like a 20-year half contract or something like that, we don't look at the underwriting as if that's going to be subsidized for the entire compliance period per this. So we can put some clarifying language in there, long-term operating subsidy.
And I think that's important from a syndicator's perspective.
It's all subject to appropriation anyway.
Exactly.
Right.
So
Congress could decide tomorrow.
Challenge. Always been the challenge, just underwriting deals.
Right, and you make a great point because we know of developments that have historically had, 80% of their units might have housing choice vouchers, right? Can't underwrite to it. Syndicators won't underwrite to it. So, we work hand in hand with the syndicators. So I would say 15 years would be good, but the challenge that is if we get more Section 8-11 vouchers, those only have a 5-year term. So I would really rather not, if we could, put a limitation on it. I think that's an underwriting, something we deal with sort of on the underwriting side. And I think
investor side.
Mm-hmm. And on the investor side. And I think from a, it's sort of how we manage risk. I think we understand the challenges and there's funds, that are going to come to us that may be unique.
But it should be project-based.
Yes.
And it should be.
But really, if you think of it, we're incentivizing creating permanent supportive housing units. It's incumbent upon the developer to take that risk. I'm going to say they're permanent supportive housing units and I have a certain amount of subsidy, but if that subsidy goes away, I've already made this commitment that they're going to be permanent supportive housing units.
And there's a difference between PSH and just folks that are extremely low income coming off of voucher lists versus the coordinated entry system. So.
Right.
And we distinguish in our scoring.
In the scoring.
Right, right. Okay, okay. I just don't want that to be, I don't know.
Well, and I think.
By somebody who can get, you know, you can get a small municipality, give them a voucher or two that's good for maybe 1 year. You're saying the risk is on the
problem. If you could identify those municipalities.
Maybe that's a minuscule backdoor. Oh.
Yeah, no, I think, I really think that that's an underwriting issue.
Okay.
So.
All right. All right.
Yeah, and I would say, I don't know if there is from the developer or the investor, you know, depending on the deal.
Yeah.
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 For
the lender.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody's going to want to see that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think a lot of times it falls back to the investor lender
because
the way the guarantees are structured.
Right.
So, yeah, I think you want to make it appealing for everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Great.
I have one quick question. Loaning from the 30%. Do we like coach developers when they're looking to do a deal? It just kind of gets back to the numbers question. So I know that we don't have an exact number, but like a percentage of the units we like to see at 30, or I mean, I think I've seen the most successful developments are when they are mixed. So you've got some at 30, you know, some at 80.
Yep.
In the perfect world. I think it's just good for vibrancy of, you know, life and encouraging people and just community. However, we do know that the 30% do require the more services. Right.
Right.
So how do you feel about like 100%, you know, at 30% versus like the mixed income and how you support the services if the 30% is a lower percentage of the number of units in that case itself?
We don't often see 100% of the units unless it is across.
Right.
Yep. Yep. Right, and they have the expertise and the background to do that type of work.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say because of the way we do our scoring, it's somewhere between 10 and 20%. It's kind of the typical, maybe, so if you look at the scoring, if you're over 20%, you get the most points. So we've seen a lot at 21%, right? And so... And I think specifically the QAP also sort of it incentivizes mixed income. It incentivizes a lot of things, so we rarely get a development that is more than 20%.
And really because of the dearth of subsidy historically,
right.
It's driven by how does the deal pencil out?
Yeah.
And can the non 30% units subsidize those 30% units and at what level? In order to make that work. And it's, you know, oftentimes a moving target for developers to try and figure out what the sweet spot is so that they're not shorting themselves on the operating side.
Okay, yep.
And to just one last thing, to Carol's point, the QAP does differentiate between those units where services are required to accompany the operating subsidy and then just, you know, extremely low-income units for families or households that don't necessarily need those supportive services, but just are low-income.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else there, Kevin?
I don't believe so. No more. Okay.
Okay. The next one, I think, is really just a sort of more ministerial, changed up to 3 funding rounds to multiple funding rounds. I would say historically for the last 10 years, we've had 1 funding round. So, page 25, section 3, this was requested by the Department of Housing, remove language regarding a preference for mid-sized developments. I don't know if anybody has any comments or questions about that. Okay. Section 3, page 25 and 26, clarified language regarding preservation transactions. And I think this was, as part of the Q&A, we received a comment from a developer who was a little bit less familiar with the QAP, and they just were seeking clarification about how preservation deals are allowed as part of the 9%, right? And so it just clarified the language that's really stated that preservation-only developments are not eligible for 9% credits, that we require that either 30% of the, it's the lower of, I'm sorry, the greater of 30% of the overall units in the application or 20 new units. So you just have to do the math. And I just cleaned up the language. Any questions? Okay. So then let's jump to page 26 and 27. Deleted the absolute total development cost as a threshold criterion. And again, this came from the Department of Housing, and there, if I understand correctly, the thoughts were twofold. One is that because several recent projects have required waivers, that the cap has less value, and because we use the weighted average total development cost based on building types, that this is enough of an incentive to contain costs.
Let's see. The idea, right, is to remove it as a threshold item, but we still see the value of having a limit to encourage cost efficiency and among many other things, and to put include it as a recommended cost, total development cost limit. And I think the appropriate place to put it would be under item 7 here, on page 27, which reads, developments that achieve these goals at a reasonable cost. Mm-hmm. And then we can include the recommended cost limit.
Yep.
I think it might make sense to do it by type, similar, perhaps, how we do, you know, in the scoring. But think about that, whether you just want one single or whether we want, say, a, an, you know, I don't know, mid-rise versus...
Whisper. Well, and those are, we, I apologize, but we do actually have those limits. They're published annually in our developer's handbook.
Right.
So
can we reference them here?
They are referenced, yeah, and they're right on the front page, first page in the scoring.
Right.
In this section, though, might we be able to reference them just so it's more explicit?
We can. We can.
I think so, but I mean, conceptually, I guess we should talk about this.
Please.
But I mean, those limits are for scoring purposes.
Yes.
Right.
But the idea was that. Maybe the limits are a little bit higher than what is used for scoring. So we can permit a project to come in that's a, you know, bit higher than that. They won't score as well as another one that is more cost efficient, but they can still come in as long as they don't go over that recommended limit. And if in fact they are over it, we have, if it's for a specific reason such as Davis-Bacon or some environmental remediation or something like that, they can justify that to go under further review.
Right. So we have, I mean, prior to taking it out, we had done the math, and we had a kind of an up to maximum cap, and we can add that in with some language.
Okay.
Off the top of my head, I don't remember what it was. It was, I think it was 5% increase over this year. So
like
429 times 1.05. So it was very close to 450.
Okay. Does anybody have any comments or
a prompt to my colleague Amy? Amy, can you hear us? Is that possible?
And yes, I can hear.
Someone?
I can hear.
So great. So just as a quick preface, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ann. What we're trying to accomplish here is something nuanced, where we signal that there's less of a hard cap and there's more of an incentive in favor of efficiency. And Amy, do you want to just, is there anything that we just said that you want to ask a question about or any other point that you want to make?
No, I think everything made sense. Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
And then I think that related to this, we might want to consider whether we also have a limit on the amount of credits per unit or an amount of eligible basis per unit. If you didn't want to have it, I mean, that's part of the NCSHA best practice to incorporate the cost limit and maybe also a credit limit or basis limit. So a project can go over, you know, maybe the recommended cost limit, but it would be a hard line for the amount of credits actually given per affordable unit. Does anyone have any thoughts on that? I think we kind of do. Maybe you could talk to that, James, a little bit.
Right. We have...
Not explicit, but it's...
Yeah, we're going into math, so you'll have to excuse me. But I think, you know, what we have is a cap of 40% of the available allocation to any one project, which is roughly
$1.25 million
right. to $1.3 million. And so you can back into it reasonably that way. And I think what we, you know, obviously we know that there's a floor on the amount of units that we want to have in a particular project to make it viable. So there is a number. What I think we can do is just, Ann can pull the recent year's data and see where we've landed for each of the successful projects and think about if it, I think we probably do capture a 40% limit already, but it's worth just looking at a side-by-side comparison just to make sure.
Comments or questions about that? Do we think that that provision should be a credit per unit cap or guidance or other form of input?
Of points or?
Yeah.
I think it could be either way.
Yeah,
it could be both. Yeah.
Open to either.
Yeah.
I do wonder whether it might be less a cap and more something else, just in case we want to vary from.
I think the flexibility we have to be able to address like a crossroads building, which is a massive building, important development, and it's expensive, but it needs to be built.
Sure.
I have to say you just got to the heart of what we're discussing. I think everyone is fully recognizing that there are instances where intensive subsidy is very merited, and in fact, it might be the most meritorious project.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I like these maps.
Yeah.
I also think it sometimes a little bit less structure on that. You can at least get the developers to the table for the conversation. They know they have to be competitive.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes if there's too many parameters, they're like, it's too hard.
It takes a concept right off the table.
Yeah.
There's no concept anymore.
Yeah,
they walk away. Yeah.
You know, I think
I agree.
I've seen that happen before.
Yeah.
We're still at 3-1 or 4-1.
4-1.
Right. So I agree with your point very much. Yeah, I think that the less is better in some ways to attract developers. I like the idea of maybe incentivizing them. If we're going to put it in, maybe we start the first time with a simple point. You know, if you want to do it that way.
On credit.
We do score credit per unit.
We're doing it right now. Where?
Yes, number two in the financials, 20 points for the most efficient use of LIHTC per unit.
Okay. All right. So we're already there.
We're on that.
Okay. Good. Any other comments or questions about?
Nope.
No? Okay.
Can I actually, I'm just backing up, I didn't comment on the elimination of the mid-sized development preference body to ask for more input. Just wanted to say out loud, there was probably a moment in time where that made sense, and the reason for that suggested revision that sounds like we're all embracing is that there certainly may be large-scale developments that we want to undertake these days, and frankly, there may be more boutique-like smaller developments, let's say crossroads, with an intensive level of subsidy and service. So just wanted to add that too. I'm sure that was self-evident, but let it go and decided to add that.
Great point. Good. Thank you. So I think we're up to 31 changes.
Right. So the first one is really just we have the threshold, we had TDC as a threshold criteria sort of listed in two separate sections, so it just caught up with that. Let's see, we jump to the scoring now, the scoring section. So page 31 and 32 really is just updated the summary of the scoring. The next one, which is page 35.
If we could pause right here.
Sure.
I think the concept here is we're going from
30 is a low point, 57. So it's...
That's correct.
19, so it's what, 15% roughly increase in the total number of points. And they're all being allocated to this section of sort of very low-income homeless and/or special needs persons.
That is correct.
Okay. So it's a big boost in points going from 6 to 25 in that one category.
Mm-hmm.
I guess leave it at that. I mean, it's a huge boost. I mean, you get 3 points if you're going after green, building or preservation, 5 for preservation and green bills and some other. So this is a substantive.
And I think it reflects the priorities of the housing department and the governor, too.
Right. And the realities of what we've seen with the point in time counts and the increase in unsheltered people and a need to address this crisis as best we can.
Right. And again, from an underwriting perspective, if they don't have the operating subsidy, it's much more challenging for us to, you know, in some ways it makes it easier to evaluate, right? Because if they're 30% units and they don't have the subsidy, it's much harder to underwrite. So it's almost like a self-cap.
The next one gets into house,
Right.
Do it really.
Right. When we get to that language, you'll see we've added some language around the importance of the operating subsidy in order to make those units financially successful.
Okay.
So then we would jump to the scoring on page, page 35. We modified some language associated with the financial leveraging, and this again came from the Department of Housing, and I think it was just sort of a acknowledgement that this year we will continue to have a lot of state dollars, so we don't want to necessarily penalize somebody for coming to us and seeking those subsidies. Now to the what we were just talking about, we increased the points associated with the provision of housing for extremely low-income households from 6 to 25 points. And I'll sort of turn it over to you. Do you want me to sort of walk through the thought again, or?
Why don't you set it up to just conceptually the thought and how, and maybe also there's certain percentage brackets and
right. Maybe
the thinking behind that.
Okay. Sure.
The supportive services versus non.
Right. And you'll see right in there we've added, before you even get to the scoring, the applicant must identify the operating subsidies for these units or use the 30% rent for underwriting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like if you don't have the subsidy, we're going to underwrite this at 30% because you're going to commit to it for 30 years, so we need to know that it's financially viable. So we've sort of talked about this. So given the need for creating deeply affordable housing and that the state is poised to repurpose the ERA funding, that for this cycle, and again, the QAP is updated annually, it makes sense to increase the points to incentivize such housing. If all of those funds, those operating funds are allocated, and if I understand correctly, because they're ARPA funds, they need to be fully committed by the end of 2024. When we come back next year for the QAP, it's something you may want to revisit, right? Because it may not make sense to be incentivizing that if you don't have the subsidy, right? So I'll kind of open it up to you folks. You'll see that we have two categories, one where the developer may be partnering with a service provider to provide supportive services. That's the up to 25 points, and it kind of goes down in 5% increments. 5-point increments based on the percentage of housing. And then for a developer who's providing 30% AMI units but really may not be focused on either the coordinated entry system or folks who require supportive services, it caps out at 18 points and drops down to 9.
So just conceptually, as I'm going through this, the way I read this is you could get up to 25 points if you have services and the rent's below 30% AMI, or if they're homeless, serving a homeless population and you have services, or if it's special needs and has services. And so what is special needs? What populations would fit into that bucket?
Persons with disabilities.
It's just those with disabilities? So would it be would just elderly be considered a special need?
I suppose if they were at 30%, they could
be. It doesn't say that.
Is it a defined term? Sorry. Special needs
right.
In the plan? I don't.
Nationally, it's a defined
term. Nationally,
right.
So you just refer back to.
Yeah. We can broaden the language, though.
And right. And I'm not sure we thought about it in terms of elderly.
I don't think that was the intent.
It really wasn't.
Crafted, it looked
so we
like.
Can say non-elderly. Or we can be more specific and say special needs.
You could have elderly people with
just
special needs.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just asking what I think we need
so we,
to
why don't,
clear.
Well,
and what is the, I guess, Department of Housing's real intent here? Is it really to get at those that are extremely low income or anyone that has maybe a special need, whether it be homeless or development disabled? Or
we were not aiming to get that specific in our input, but
right, okay.
Certainly aiming for lowest income to be a priority, but beyond that.
We can clarify that language.
Okay. I guess that I think where we probably come out is that we don't want to give all these points to something that's solely elderly.
No. Correct. And we can make that clarification.
Okay. And then it says a service plan, a memorandum of understanding with the service providers required for homes that are intended for persons with special needs. So should one be required in all instances?
We can clarify that. Yep.
And then I think later on in the QAP, although you might want to restate it just to be clear, that it should be obviously appropriate. The services should be appropriate for the population being served, and it should be by, you know, we asset management reviews it, approves it, and all those good things. And then lastly, I was wondering, this is a little chunky, I think, and I think it's fine because we don't normally have, you know, projects at the end of the day. There may be a half a point away from each other. Usually it's a pretty clear break, but instead of these chunks, because I think most people are just going to go, you know, they'll do 11% to get the 15 points. They're not going to do 15% to get that, you know. So should we just give, like, you know, a certain number of points per percentage of units set aside? You know, like it's,
we can prorate within these buckets. Is that what you're asking?
I would say just do away with the buckets and just make it
above.
Yeah, like 1.5 points for, well, what is it? You've got, you want to hit basically 20% and 20, so it's like it's almost like a point per percentage of units. Right, 1 point per 1% of units, essentially. A little more than that, but if you, so in instance, you get 20 points if you had 20% of your units set aside. Or if you had 18, you get 18 points. It just makes it a finer gradation instead of being chunky like this. You might want to look at that.
Okay. I know you folks were very, concerned about it matching the 25 points for total development costs, so that would come in with a slightly lower percentage.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
The gradation approach would, or is
the gradation of points might, depending on sort of how we.
Because you'd have to get it to 1 point something or other per. I see.
I can see both points of view, and you have a perspective.
I think I'd rather sort of think about it and do the math before I respond.
Well, that was why we had this meeting into July's meeting.
I mean, and as you all know, we post the draft for public comment.
Right.
We have a public meeting, and we take written comments for 30 days starting either, I think it's tomorrow, and then we bring it back for another approval. So.
And I think that the concept that was displayed here to me is that you get roughly 50% more points if you're providing the services than you simply do if you're providing the units at 30% AMI or for the special needs or homeless, et cetera. I think it's smart. We want to incentivize services coming along with these units, or these units to serve this population, rather. I think it makes sense to use a percentage of total number of units in development, but have you thought about just actual number of units? Like points per number of units instead?
I think this is my opinion only. Because of the scale we're operating on, the fine gradations don't matter as much. If we're talking about a 40-unit development and 10 units are for this population, that's 25%. If we're talking about 8 units, that's 20%, right? So there's 21% doesn't get you an extra unit. You know what I mean? Like that type of, if we're talking a 400-unit development, then those become more important and more significant in terms of getting more units or incentivizing one more unit or two or three more units here, I think, just because of, and again, we're veering into math, so I do apologize. It may not be as fine a distinction to make. You might not be buying anything for doing it that finely.
Oh, I get that. I guess my question this time, though, is instead of utilizing or giving points for the percentage of units in the total development, would we give points for just actual numbers of units? So, say, 1 point for each unit provided in a development.
Well, I almost think that for the same reason has a deleterious effect, because then you'd be getting 10 points for 10 units in a 40 unit development instead of for 25% of the units. You know what I mean?
And
I guess.
And we want to encourage, if you do an 80 unit development, I want that higher percentage.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I guess. Well, I think that's it. Do we care about the overall number of units, or do we really want to encourage it being a smaller percentage in an overall larger deal, kind of like back to what you said, Maria? Like, we want a 30-unit or a 25-unit development with all 25 units, you know, for special needs, homeless, et cetera, or do we want 25 units out of a 100-unit development? Which do we prefer?
Well, do we have any sense for what the market is capable of producing? In other words, if the highly subsidized, high service intensity units are typically in smaller clusters, then we don't want to bias against that. In other words, if the development is likely to happen in smaller batches, and I suspect it is, but I just want to see what do we think, because if we're
utilizing
smaller numbers of units, then we're not going to get there.
So a crossroads project is going to be 100%, right? And so that's going to get the maximum amount of points no matter how you slice it. The ones we're trying to grab are the folks who are not 100%, who are trying to think about how can I serve this population with a portion of my development, and what's the best way to incentivize that production for somebody who may not otherwise have initially thought of it as part of their program, but, oh, wow, there's points are available, and there's now, for the first time in a long time, there might be some subsidy available to make it feasible. How do we get the most bang for the buck out of that?
And in addition to that, how do we encourage more relationships and partnerships in the service sector, right? So we're really challenged there, and the need to develop new partners that have traditionally not been at the table. So
do these service providers work best, say, if it's 5 units in a development versus 50 units in a development that they're serving?
Well, I think it does. I think it depends on the agency. I think it depends upon the partnerships and the acuity level of the folks living in the units, what their needs are. So I think all of that, Kevin, right? And there's no one size fits all when you approach this. And I think we try very hard to do the best we can to incentivize a percentage of units included in each deal. And we've had some very good success in having that happen.
The other thing is, you know, we have other metrics throughout the QAP, and they're based on percentages. So I think for consistency purposes, it might be helpful if we sort of maintained the percentage. And we can look at sort of cleaning this up, and maybe it ends up being slightly less than 25 points if we, you know, based on how we look at the math. But I just...
Yeah, and I think there are few developers in Rhode Island that will do a 50-unit supportive housing transaction, right? I mean, there are limitations. But there are lots of developers who are willing to incorporate, you know, supportive housing in a development for a percentage mm-hmm. of the
there
unit.
There might be a lot of developers, but are there the social service organizations that can operate efficiently and successfully with a limited number of units and overall project? I mean, I think
yes.
the answer is you think it's yes, because you're certainly encouraging just 10 or 20% of the units to be that way. But I just am asking that question. I know on some of my properties, you know, we have some extremely low income disabled that need those services, and it's kind of hard to get that provider to come out.
I think that it doesn't matter how many units you have at that point. I don't think it matters. No, I think it's a matter of I think it's about the relationship with the service provider. Does the developer have an RSC that's also backing that up and
right.
monitoring the development?
Right.
And
right.
we are aggressively pushing RSCs at the property level, because I think that makes a world of difference.
Right. It's a high touch.
Yes.
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 Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we have to do more of that. Rely on our service providers, our mental health associations, more into the medical field, right, the community
yeah.
health centers, and we're going down that path with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant. So I think we need more players, new players, and a strong presence at the development level.
I agree. I think occasionally you get an amazing project like Crossroads where you've got
yeah.
really good
that's what they do.
Who can has the wherewithal to do it, right?
Yeah.
And so many levels.
Yeah.
The services, the fundraising, you know, make it all work. So that's amazing and
mm-hmm.
really impactful. I think you're right. The way we're going to move the dial right now, I think, is like one step at a time.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a little bit here, a little bit there. And this incentive, I think, is going to help people. I think it would be good to look at the math. I hear what you're saying about the units. I also see what you're saying about percentage, particularly if it's a 40-unit project,
right?
You can only do so much. And I think the more we do to help share the service ideas in a small state like Rhode Island, there's opportunity here.
Mm-hmm.
Logistically, it's doable.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say any state really has that completely figured out. So
right. It's challenging.
It's challenging.
It's a huge challenge.
It's a huge challenge.
But you have to do it.
But we have a huge opportunity here. Mm-hmm. I really believe that.
Do we go to the point of having, and maybe we do this for market studies and appraisals and things like that, do we go to a list of approved, like, social service providers, like pre-approved or something that we've vetted, or do you just want to see what developers come up with?
I think it's up to the developers to,
mm-hmm.
not for us to dictate who they partner with. They make those connections, and usually they have long-standing relationships with certain providers, and that's who they, you know, a developer, like anything else, you develop a relationship with a lender, or you develop a relationship with your syndicator, you're developing a relationship with a service provider. Maybe it's regional, maybe it's, you know, it's a small state, so it could be statewide here, too.
Any other comments or questions about this?
Is the level of service provided or the quality of the service that's provided any way measured or any way rated? And the reason why I'm asking is because you get 18 points without, but you'll get 25 if you're at the max, but it could be not a great service.
So I would say a couple things. One is, we're a housing organization, so I don't want to put myself in the position of saying you're a good service provider, you're not necessarily, to a prospective developer. I think certainly they provide qualifications to us and say we have this agreement with service provider X that's done all of these different things, and that's something that we look at, but I don't feel qualified to make those determinations or to dictate to somebody who you
can. Or about the amount of services, if it's just like one small thing that's offered compared to another developer that comes in with a project that has services, they should have more of a point.
Well,
I don't know. It seems, I know it's a hard thing to do.
Right.
It's a very hard thing for us to evaluate.
Yeah.
Because somebody can come in on paper and say they're going to do all of these wonderful things, and when the rubber meets the road,
they're not that great.
They're not that great. So I feel very comfortable about underwriting these deals. That's what we do. I feel less. On less solid ground, evaluating service provision packages and things like that in this context.
And if later on in the QAP, we also have another section specifically toward prioritized services where you get, you can get up to 4 points, and it's sort of, if you're giving childcare, that's 2 points. If you're having an art class, it's 0.5 points, right? So it's, yes. So we're incentivizing services overall, even if it's not. So maybe you're in that, you're getting the 18 points, but you're offering childcare in your building, or you're running GED classes, right? So you're providing different kind of services. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That can give more leeway towards that.
Yeah, and those are also not just for 30% units, and it could be for a regular family development. They have, as Ann said, job training or GED classes or things of that nature, that they would get a little bit of a bonus for providing those services.
Chris, did you want
to? As part of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant, we're working on the other side to create toolkits for providers and to create tools to measure how well the services perform and put those in the contracts and the agreements that the developer has. So I hear you, and we're struggling to figure out how to measure it, but we are working on it and working on it from both sides, right? So incentivizing the creation of those units and the provision of services, working on the other side to improve them.
And is there a partnership with another state organization? Is that part of the grant?
The steering committee. We've got UHHS and BUDA and housing and all the players that we can get at the table to collaborate and to contribute ideas and consultants and best practices. And we meet with the larger group that got the grant. So it's really quiet but robust effort, right?
Do you think that might come by next meeting or something?
No, we'll have.
I think it probably next year.
End of the year. We're scheduled to put together a plan, and there are only, I think, 6 other HFAs that were awarded these grants, and I'm hoping that there's more money behind it to take that toolkit and to really do great work with it.
Okay.
So maybe next year in the QAP, some of the results of that planning grant that we
can inform it.
The SHC will be reflected in the QAP, but I'm not quite sure we're there.
Sure, now that's
not there yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Move on to the next one.
All right. I think the next one will be a little less controversial. We modified the language associated with planning and zoning, basically to clarify, and I think this was a good point from one of the stakeholders, is, rarely do we, I think we had language in there around, having building permits. They don't have building permits when they come to us, and if they do, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're ready to go. So we just cleaned up the language around there and also identified you know, some of the municipal permitting bodies that, you know, that might be required. Questions there?
Yes. I see that building permit was struck.
Right.
The fire code was added. Do we think that there is a likelihood that a project would come with fire code approvals?
It's a good question. I think it depends on the level of the plans.
Mm-hmm.
So potentially, yes. I think it's you know, it's unlikely that you're going to have somebody who's at 90% plans, but you might, and if they have the fire code approval. And one of the reasons why we put that in there is there are a lot of municipalities that choose not to make the fire code determination, and then they kick it up to the state.
Yeah.
It can be a lengthy process. So. And again, it's really around that threshold of readiness to proceed, because I think, you know, historically we had one application that came in and they, you know, they had their building permit with them. Their plans were only like 30% done. Like, how do you get a building permit with 30% plans? So we're just trying to keep people from gaming the system, I guess, is an inelegant way of saying that.
But you think fire has some value. It could be accomplished.
It could be. I think it's unlikely, but it could be. And then the last is really just a further, we talked about this earlier, the added language around the 4% credit process, which is really later on in the process, but we've added a reference to it up in the front section.
I think this is smart to include this. I think I think, you know, we could certainly expand on. I think this is a very good first step. Conceptually, and I've thrown this out before, I'll throw it out again. This is like related to this. But does that make sense for a 4% transaction?
What?
I know we have what is it now? 157 or something now. I mean, it could be a low threshold, but do we want to at least have a threshold that they have to satisfy?
We don't technically score these tax-exempt applications at all. And historically, we have, up until a year ago, 99% of the applications that came to us for tax-exempt bonds were preservation deals, many of which didn't need any soft money, right? So we just took them on a rolling basis. We had plenty of volume cap. They're good deals for us. It's, you know, rehabs the units, extends the affordability, keeps them in our portfolio. What we started to do when we had this, you know, influx of ARPA dollars was, again, take applications for tax-exempt bonds on a rolling basis and then score them for the soft dollars, because those are the applications that would come in a competitive round. And I think it does work, because much of the scoring associated with the ancillary dollars reflects the QAP, maybe a little bit broader. It's not quite as fine-tuned, but I think the concepts are the same, and so I think we get there, that's really why we still have not added in the scoring for the 4%, and I don't know if Carol feels differently, but, you know, after this round, when we have all of these state dollars, I think we're going to be back to where we were. With excess
I'm going to apply on our housing department column to make sure we have boatloads of money to be able to use 4% credit. So, but I think it's a good point. We're in a situation that we haven't been in with my 20 years and 20 years of doing deals at Rhode Island Housing. So it might be maybe not for this
round, but maybe moving forward coming up with something for the 4% transactions.
Tap?
Right now for the multifamily, they would always, that would always be our first use of the cap.
Yes.
Okay.
Any comments or questions about this section on the 4%? Or?
For right now, I agree the feature to figure out, but I think it's great, and a lot of states don't have 4% money.
Right.
They're bumping up against this. They're sharing it with so many people.
Yeah.
Any other comments or questions at large? Okay. Do you have any comments or questions or clarifying it, or if you do, reach out. And,
okay.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And thank you, Mr. Secretary and Amy for these very good comments. I think it's going to make for a very good QAP.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman of the Committee, for your receptivity and to the staff for metabolizing this and really making it happen. I think this was a really strong model of how we can work together. It's great.
I'll make a motion to adjourn
then. You have to vote to approve it.
Mr. Committee Chair, all right, I'd like to just restate what the motion will be, because if I'm understanding correctly, there are a couple modifications.
Yes.
So as I understand it, the motion will be to recommend the approval of the proposed 2024 qualified allocation plan as modified pursuant to today's discussion, to clarify the marketing to the tenant-based voucher holders, to include the previous total development cap limits as a recommendation under item 7 in that section 3, to clarify the special needs points, and to clarify the appropriateness of supportive services to the service population, those four changes. Have I stated that correctly?
Yeah, and don't forget, there's also public comment, so there may be other changes that get reflected as
well.
We're
moving on that now. This is just
okay.
Right, understood. Just want to make sure that the committee's comments are distilled for purposes of getting the proposal published.
Can we simply say pursuant to our discussion today?
Absolutely. I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page.
Always trying to help get put in there, just making sure she nailed it.
Okay. I think you did. I think you did.
Okay.
Do you want to hear it again?
I'm fine with that as long as what you said can satisfy or whether I need to repeat it.
Oh, no. No need to repeat it.
No. If you want to hear it from Corey.
Okay. May I have a motion, please?
So moved.
Second. Thank you very much. Corey, would you please take a vote?
Thank you so much. All those in favor of recommending the approval of the proposed 2024 qualified allocation plan as discussed at this meeting, please say aye. Any opposed, say nay. The motion's approved. Thank you.
So much.
Well done.
Thank you.
Very proud of us. Thank you.